This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Coronavirus vaccines are in high demand worldwide, but access to them is still patchy at best.
Today, 130 countries haven't even had one inoculation. Not even one.
I'm Carol Hills. As the war in Yemen continues, some observers say time for a diplomatic solution has run out.
There needs to be a military action to weaken the Houthis in order to force them to come to the negotiation table.
And how about that Mars landing yesterday?
Safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the sands of past life.
Well, it was historic for more than one reason. That story and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We made it to Friday. President Joe Biden spoke at the Munich Security Conference today. He attended virtually and sent this message. The U.S. is back and it wants to mend ties with its European allies. Biden pointed to a series of crises that the U.S. and Europe face, like the pandemic, threats from Russia, and a rising China. Another concern? Iran. Biden says it wants to start negotiating with Iran to curb its nuclear program after the Trump administration walked away from a previous deal about this. The World's Shirin Jafari has more.
President Biden's staff has already put his words into action. Yesterday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with foreign ministers of France, Germany, and the UK. He said the US is ready to join them to restore the 2015 nuclear accord. Restoring the deal won't be a walk in the park, though. After President Trump pulled out of the agreement in 2018, relations between Iran and the US took a turn for the worse. Trump and his team began what they called the maximum pressure campaign, a series of harsh economic sanctions. Iran, on the other hand, doubled down on its support for militia groups in the region. It also ramped up its nuclear program. Today, though, Biden struck a different tone.
That's why we said we're prepared to re-engage in negotiations with the P5 plus one on Iran's nuclear program.
The P5 plus one are the five permanent members of the UN Security Council: China, France, Russia, the UK, the US, plus Germany. Holly Dagres is with the Atlantic Council in Washington. She says before coming back to the table, the Iranians want an end to the sanctions.
They don't see any benefit of returning to a deal if the U.S. isn't holding their side of the bargain. And so I think until they get those sanctions removed, Iran is just going to keep moving forward with rolling back its nuclear program.
That's what Javad Zarif, Iran's foreign minister, tweeted today. In response to Biden's offer, he wrote that the U.S. is no longer party to the original deal, and so it must lift all sanctions before it can proceed. Adnan Tabatabai, an Iran analyst in Germany, believes that Iran is taking this position, partly because the government has to make a case to its people that re-engaging with the U.S. won't end the way it did last time, with the U.S. walking away.
The relations with the U.S. and the ups and downs have an immediate impact on Iran's economy.
Just look at Iran's currency, for example, he says. Its values goes up when there's talk of diplomacy and goes down when the relations hit south.
Walking towards sanctions relief and economic relief is something that the average Iranian person would like to see rather yesterday than today.
So the expectations are high, he says. The U.S., for its part, is walking a fine line, too. It has to take into account what ultimately led to the demise of the previous accord. Concerns from some countries who say lifting sanctions on Iran will mean it has more money to finance militia groups who go on to destabilize the region. But Adnan Tabatabai doesn't see Iran willing to consider anything other than its nuclear program at this moment. The deal is also called the JCPOA.
The JCPOA has been and still is solely about Iran's nuclear program. But when it comes to regional affairs, obviously then this also has to do with what Saudi Arabia, what Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and other countries are doing in the region. And then obviously others have to be at the table.
Holly Dagres of the Atlantic Council says don't expect sanctions to be lifted tomorrow.
Not all these sanctions can be removed so easily. Yes, some of them can be removed with an executive order, but some of them that are related to terrorism take a little bit more time and are a lot more complicated.
To add to the complications, she says, Iran is holding its presidential elections in June. That could mean a more hardline government in Tehran, unwilling to cooperate with Washington. So even with this week's development, she says, getting to a final agreement with Iran will be long and complicated. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Prison or exile? That's the choice facing many opposition politicians in Belarus under the rule of Alexander Lukashenko, the country's president for more than 26 years. Now, journalists there are facing similar threats. Yesterday, two independent journalists, Katerina Andreeva and Daria Shutsova, were sentenced to prison for covering protests. Belarusian authorities say they violated the public order, among other charges. We're joined now by Katya Glad. She's a Belarus analyst with SIPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis, and she joins us from London. Katya, tell us about this case of Katerina Andreeva and Daria Shutsova. What does the charge violating public order mean?
Well, the charge violating public order in present-day Belarus does not really correspond to reality. That basically means that the journalists were performing their work. They were live streaming from a protest event in Belarus. The authorities said that it was a public gathering and the journalists, by filming the protest, they committed an act of public disorder.
Now, what kind of prison sentence did they receive?
The two journalists were sentenced to 2 years of imprisonment, each of them. And this is another in a series of attacks against journalists in Belarus. We have seen that evolving since June last year. And now this is really the culmination of this attack on freedom of speech in Belarus. We have seen really hundreds of similar cases against ordinary protesters happening in Belarus. So it's a massive scare tactic on the part of the regime towards the protesters to not let the public resistance, which we have seen in Belarus in recent months, continue, not let it go.
Remind us of the context here. I mean, why have there been so many mass protests in Belarus starting since last August?
Last August, on the 9th of August, there was a presidential election in Belarus, which Alexander Lukashenko claims that he had won in a landslide victory, claiming 80% of the vote. But the election was neither free nor fair. And when election day happened, people took to the streets. Several days later, the whole country learned about torture, about violence, brutality of the police towards those protesters who came out on election day to protest against this 80% that Lukashenko claimed for himself. And since then, the protests haven't really stopped.
Now, you mentioned how in the past 6 months or so, many Belarusian activists and journalists and politicians and just regular citizens have been detained and imprisoned. Do you have a sense of how many are still in custody?
We have the figures that since May, there have been over 33 cases of prosecution of different people, of ordinary protesters, of politicians, of human rights defenders, of journalists as well. Many of them obviously have been released, but I think we still have several hundred people in prison. And the attacks against journalists, against protesters, against human rights continue.
Now, notably, the leader of the Democratic Belarus movement, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, is in exile. What has she and her team been up to?
It's true that most of the opposition political leaders from Belarus, they are either outside in exile or in prison. Mrs. Tikhanovskaya's team, they're based in Vilnius, and they have very much focused their efforts on putting the international pressure on the regime of Lukashenko, as well as helping the victims of repression. So Svetlana Tikhanovskaya's office is compiling a list of those oligarchs, big businessmen who support the regime, to put them under the international sanctions. They are also initiating human rights cases, so-called international jurisdiction, when if the case cannot take place within the country for political reasons, for example, then some countries in Europe, they are able to start criminal proceedings in their own countries, even though they're trying to charge and prosecute people of a different citizenship.
What about Alexander Lukashenko himself? He said that he will work on constitutional reforms. Anything happened so far?
Last week, he conducted the so-called All Belarusian Assembly. There was a resolution saying that we should expect a referendum on the constitutional amendment sometime in December, late December. However, this is very much a delaying tactic. Lukashenko clearly does not want to leave. He feels more confident now once he has suppressed big protests. He thinks that he still has the support of the Kremlin. And therefore, what he's looking for, he's really looking for how to continue to retain power. A lot will depend on how the Kremlin will look at that. We know that there is personal animosity between Putin and Lukashenko, and the Kremlin would like Lukashenko to step down because he's not really very predictable. But on the other hand, they don't have so many leverages over him. So therefore, Lukashenko is quite confident having the support.
Katya Glad is a political analyst with SEPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis. She's been talking with us about the latest developments in Belarus. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Comedy is subjective. What may be funny to me may not be funny to you. In China, stand-up comedian Yang Li has found that a lot of men don't find her funny. In fact, some men go so far as to say there's nothing funny about the fact that female comedians are on the rise in China. Stephanie Studer writes for The Economist. She talked about the controversy over female comedians in China with Jason Palmer of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Here's a portion of their conversation.
就是他明明为什么看起来那么普通，但是他却可以那么自信。
So here, Yang Li was telling her audience the following joke. Men are adorable, but mysterious. After all, they can look so average and yet be so full of confidence. Now, that may not seem so risque to Western ears used to stand-up comedy with far more insulting humour. But in this case, many Chinese men took offence. And indeed, a group of them in December reported Miss Yang to China's broadcast regulator for sexism.
And so who is Yang Li?
Yang Li is a 28-year-old comedian.
大家好，我是杨丽.
She last year earned the title of Punchline Queen on Rock and Roast, which is a fantastically popular competitive stand-up comedy show where a panel and the audience get to vote for their favourite comedian. And a lot of female comedians have been appearing on this show, which is giving them a new and real prominence in China. And a lot of them are turning to this form of comedy because it is freer than traditional types of Chinese comedy and allows them to express themselves in lots of new ways. And they're also bringing up subjects that are often seen in China as being indecent for a woman to be discussing. But male audiences are now unhappy about becoming the butt of the joke.
So about this backlash then against Ms. Yang, what effect do you think that'll have on the scene?
Ms. Yang, for her part, has been inspired by the furore around her gag to create a new one. In this one, she relates an exchange with a male comedian who rather approvingly notes that she is testing men's limits with her jokes. And her mock incredulous response to that is, do men have limits?
男人还有底线吗?
That's Chinese comedian Yang Li ending the conversation there between Stephanie Studer and Jason Palmer in a recent episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. To hear more of their conversation about female comedians in China, just go to wherever you get your podcasts. You're with The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. There's been intense fighting outside of the Yemeni city of Marib. Houthi militias, who control Yemen's capital and much of the country already, have renewed their military campaign to take over the city. Resistance fighters are defending Marib with military support from Saudi Arabia, which has provided airstrikes and now ground troops. This is happening just as a change in the White House signals a new effort to end the Yemen war diplomatically. President Biden's new special envoy for Yemen, Tim Lender King, spoke with reporters Tuesday. He said the uptick in fighting will lead to the internal displacement of more people.
The potential for, you know, more IDPs to either flee in or out of Marib is something that is going to push an already stretched humanitarian infrastructure beyond the breaking point.
Yesterday, the United Nations Special Envoy Martin Griffiths told the Security Council in a Zoom call that the Houthi attack on Marib must stop.
The quest for territorial gain by force threatens all of the prospects of the peace process.
But not everyone sees a diplomatic solution at hand. Nadwa Al-Dawsari is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, and she is from Yemen. Al-Dawsari knows the city of Marib well, and when we reached her in Washington, she told us what's at stake in this push by the Houthis to take control of Marib.
Marib is the last stronghold of the Yemeni government. It is also a city that hosts 3 million civilians, including almost a million IDPs who fled mainly from the north, from Houthi persecution, but also from the war in general. Marib also sits on much of Yemen oil and all Yemen gas.
So you mentioned IDPs, internally displaced persons. How many people have fled to Marib during the civil war?
The numbers reported are 800,000 civilians. But a lot of people also relocated to Marib and bought homes because the city has become an example of stability. There are services, there is electricity, 24 hours, there are jobs. So it has created a lot of opportunities during the war that other parts of the country did not have.
Now, given how strategic Marib is and the concern over a humanitarian disaster there, if the Houthis take over, who is defending Marib? Who is aiding the people of Marib to keep that from happening?
The people who are defending Marib now are the tribes. They're defending their homes because they know that if Houthis take over, they'll do to them what they did to other tribes in areas they captured. They'll blow up their homes, they'll execute their tribal leaders, they'll rule with repression. So they understand the risk and they're willing to defend their homes to their death.
You have built a solid reputation as a scholar who really understands Yemen's tribes. What does that tell you about what needs to happen to prevent Marib from falling to the Houthis?
There is only one thing that can prevent Marib from falling into the hands of the Houthis. There needs to be one big military operation, well planned, well executed, to push the Houthis far enough from Marib so that they don't pose a threat to the city in the future.
So does that mean that the only country who can really help out is Saudi Arabia, the country being accused of stoking and keeping the Yemeni war going?
Look, I agree. Saudi Arabia has contributed negatively to the Yemen war, but we're talking about an immediate risk, and having to deal with that immediate risk, unfortunately, entails military support.
But it's been 6 years, and no one has seemed to be able to defeat the Houthis.
Well, again, the reasons are two things. One, the Saudis have not been providing enough military support to the tribes. The second reason is that the UN has been calling for constant ceasefire, which only the Saudis and the Hadi government accepted, but not the Houthis.
We've heard the United Nations and the U.S. government under Donald Trump and now under Joe Biden all say some version of this sentence. The war in Yemen cannot be won militarily. It must be a diplomatic solution. Who would have to be at the negotiating table for that to happen?
This narrative is extremely naive. The Houthis are not listening. They're not willing to de-escalate. So how can you negotiate with that? There needs to be a military action to weaken the Houthis in order to force them to come to the negotiation table in good faith.
What if the Houthis do besiege the city? What happens then?
If Houthis besiege the city, I think they're going to try to enter the city by force. I'm sure they will be faced with a lot of armed resistance. So I think we're likely to see an escalation in fighting within the city and around the city for at least a while, because again, Houthis are superior militarily and they will be able to crush resistance. But I think it will come at a high cost.
Nadwa Al-Dawsari is a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute. She's been speaking to us about the latest chapter in the Yemen war, the battle over Marib. Nadwa, thanks for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Years of civil war have forced millions of Yemenis to find homes elsewhere. Many have gone across the waters to Ethiopia in East Africa. That's where the world's Halima Gikandi met one man whose family has started a new life there.
Late night in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa, some restaurants are still open. One of them is called Yemen Kings, which, as you can guess, specializes in Yemeni food. Here I meet the owner's son, Karim Gamal. He works at the cash register.
We all have the love of Ethiopia, so as a family, my father and my uncle, they decided to have their restaurant in Ethiopia. And I think it's a good choice of them.
A good choice indeed. The place has become popular since they opened in 2019. During the day, the restaurant is crowded with people from all kinds of backgrounds. Gamal tells me about one of their most popular dishes, fassa.
It's a food that you could find it in all Yemen houses. It's a tradition food. The fassa is made of meat or beef, smashed beef. And they burn it in fire in a high temperature.
It's a stew that's so hot it can burn your fingers if you aren't careful. In both Ethiopia and Yemen, most meals are eaten with your hands. I had tried fassa the week before, but on this day, I was rushing to the airport, so I had a sandwich instead, made out of grilled meat. It goes perfectly with kerkide, says Gamal. That's a drink made out of dried roses.
It's dried. After it's dried, they sink it in water. Some people make it like boil it in hot water, and some people just sink it in water. Then they serve it with sugar or without sugar.
Gamal says these are the flavors of his home back in Yemen, the ones that people are seeking when they come here. Yemeni cuisine is well known across the Arab world, and that's what keeps people coming back, says Gamal.
Most of the Yemenis also, they come here and they feel that they have the taste of Yemen and the flavor of Yemen that they are missing here in Ethiopia.
Yemen and Ethiopia are not too far apart, and they have a long shared history. Gamal is proof of that. He's half Ethiopian and half Yemeni, and so is his father. His family moved to Addis after the war broke out in Yemen in 2014. And in recent years, a wave of Yemenis have followed the same path to Ethiopia.
Oh, Ethiopia is the most unbelievable country. Actually, I want to cry when I say this because many people in my country have suffered and they come to Ethiopia and Ethiopia have served them in a very good way.
The civil war in Yemen is now in its sixth year, and in recent months, Ethiopia has been embroiled in its own violent conflict in the northern region of Tigray. But here in this restaurant, there's a moment of peace for everyone. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
And you're listening to The World.
Hello, Marco here. This past year, listeners continued to show their unwavering support for The World. Together, we raised over $100,000. Thanks to the following people that helped us reach our goal. People like Elizabeth Keating, Anne Schluter, Julie Miller, James McClellan, Christian Hick, Elizabeth Brown, Karen Calzago, Paul Wolfson, Christina Witzberger, and Stephen Duncan. You guys are fantastic. Thank you all for helping us bring human-centered journalism to listeners all around the world.
Thank you.
In Poland, you might be surprised what could land a group of activists in jail: posters of the Virgin Mary with a rainbow-colored halo.
A very peaceful symbol that is optimistic and says a lot about human equality and about love and respect for each other.
Rainbows are a crime? That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. President Biden today pledged $4 billion for global vaccines. That's real money. But wealthy nations have already bought up more than half of the global vaccine supply, and millions of people living in countries at war are at special risk. So some policymakers and aid groups are calling for global vaccination ceasefires to halt conflicts at least long enough for those living in war zones to get COVID vaccines. Jan Egeland thinks vaccine ceasefires aren't a pipe dream. He's the former UN Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and current head of the Norwegian Refugee Council.
It's difficult, but it's doable. For the simple reason that if there is one thing commanders, armed men, dislike, it is a pandemic. It's epidemic disease that will cross front lines, affect their soldiers, and infect their civilian populations. So they have a self-interest in such a ceasefire. The problem very often is lack of unity of command, many different parties to a conflict. So it's a big job, but it is doable.
Where has it worked before?
Well, I was myself involved in Syria when I led an international group of countries involved in securing access to civilian populations. There were vaccination drives led by the World Health Organization and UNICEF, and ceasefires were negotiated district by district, region by region, and largely succeeded. Even in Syria, Central America, there have been many such ceasefires, El Salvador, Guatemala, the civil wars of Central America. I think it's more difficult, for example, in Eastern Congo, in North Kivu, one of the areas where Ebola now is again spreading. There are 120 armed groups. So how do you negotiate a ceasefire with all of them?
Now, UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has been urging the UN Security Council to call for a vaccine ceasefire. But isn't that putting the cart ahead of the horse, given that so many countries are too impoverished to even have a supply of vaccines? I mean, isn't the issue right now equitable access to the vaccine before calling for ceasefires?
Indeed. Today, 130 countries haven't even had one inoculation. Not even one. But there is vaccine in the pipeline. There is this COVAX initiative under the World Health Organization. The US is also now pledging money. So in the course of the year, there will be vaccines coming. By that time, there should be a plan for the rollout, and that would require painstaking negotiations with all of the parties.
I'm curious, can you think of a place where a ceasefire for vaccinations happened and then mediators and others involved were actually able to build on that pause to halt the conflict itself?
I've been involved in many peace processes through my time. And among the early confidence-building measures, there is always, we would often call it a pause in the fighting to do vaccination drives or other health campaigns. An exchange of prisoners could follow, the safe passage of refugees could follow, and later would come the much more difficult questions of sharing of power, constitutional reform, amnesties for fighters, and all of that.
I want to get back to the supply issue, because when it comes to COVID-19, we hear time and time again that no one is safe until everyone is safe. But affluent countries seem to be monopolizing vaccine supplies. Is that just the cold, hard reality?
So far it is. I mean, 75% of vaccination so far has been in 10 out of the 200 nations and territories on Earth. So 190 countries share the remaining 25%, and of those, 130 countries haven't even received the vaccine yet. So it has to change dramatically.
It's interesting because even now in 2021, people in wealthy nations tend to talk about sharing the vaccine as a question of kind of charity and helping out, and can the wealthy afford to be generous? That sort of thinking feels like a relic from the past, doesn't it?
It does, because indeed, in a globalized world, the pandemic will come back to haunt us in the north if we don't help societies in the south. The ideal would be all health personnel in all countries would have it first, then other vulnerable groups, then humanitarian workers across the world, and then in the end, office workers that like you and I would get it. This would be the rational way. World is not a rational place, unfortunately.
You work with refugees. What refugee crisis do you see as the most urgent in terms of needing vaccines?
Syria has caused the largest number of displaced people in a generation. So that would be my number one place to have vaccinations across the board of all of these displaced populations. Yemen is the largest humanitarian crisis on earth, where there is starvation and malnutrition among millions. Venezuela in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, there are really too many candidates for this. Norwegian Refugee Council has 15,000 humanitarian workers across 30 armed conflicts. None of our staff has gotten the vaccine yet, and none of the people we work for, millions of displaced people, have even seen a vaccination. With one exception, Jordan has given priority even to Syrian refugees, and I want to hold up Jordan as one shining example of some solidarity.
Jan Egeland heads the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's also the former UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief. Thanks so much, Jan Egeland.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
New coronavirus variants are continuing to emerge in recent days, and they're causing real concern.
New data on the contagious UK variant
suggests cases of the highly contagious UK variant.
The South African strain has become the dominant strain.
And Brazilian variants of the coronavirus have now entered India.
One of those concerns is what to call these variants and how to avoid stigmatizing the places where they've been identified. As the world's Alana Gordon reports, this is opening up an urgent scientific debate about nomenclature.
3 weeks ago, Jeremy Camille, a virologist at LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport, wrote an email to colleagues.
Subject: interesting new quote-unquote Q677P spike lineage in Louisiana.
Q677P is a technical way to describe a specific mutational change on part of that coronavirus spike protein and its genetic lineage. He noticed this change was present in several variants he had identified in Louisiana and other parts of the country. And so he wrote,
"And the viruses are from all sorts of different collection sites. All appear to be B.1.2GH/NextStrain20G clade."
These letters and numbers represent another way to name specific parts of the genomic code of a virus and its noticeable evolutionary changes. Even to scientists, they can be a mouthful.
In a scientific paper, you write those things, but they're not fun to read.
Within days, his colleagues started searching and found similar variants. Emma Hodcroft got pulled into the Slack chats and emails. She's a genetic epidemiologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland.
As soon as we started talking about this, I realized very quickly this was going to be a real problem. Even just to talk to each other, we were going to mess up and get confused about which one we were talking about.
Biology has its own languages, and for this coronavirus, there are two main systems that scientists use to classify the variants that they call of concern. It's a lot, and on top of that, the world is paying really close attention. Without an easy way to say and remember them, a shorthand has formed based on geography, where variants were first identified. UK, Brazil, South Africa, even scientists refer to them this way.
I'm from the UK. It doesn't upset me when they call it the UK variant.
Paul Lienash is a virologist at Rockefeller University in New York.
When virologists speak to each other, we know that we're talking about just a straightforward designation without attaching any blame. It would be different if the president of a foreign country was calling it the UK virus constantly.
As in the way former President Donald Trump used the phrase China virus. Language matters. Asian American communities have become targets of discrimination and violence. History is rife with troubling examples of how naming viruses after places can be misleading and turn toxic. Heinrich Vollmink is a public health doctor and consultant based in Johannesburg and a former member of parliament in South Africa.
When you do that, you are creating the possibility of scapegoating. It's irresponsible at best and really divisive and downright destructive at worst.
Vollmink says this is a particular issue in South Africa, given its own divisive history.
There's a great sensitivity to anything that would take us back into a space of labeling, especially when there's a really negative connotation.
Officials there are purposely referring to the variant by its technical name, 501V2. The World Health Organization has guidelines for naming viruses and came up with the technical names SARS-CoV-2 and the more common COVID-19. Now they realize these variants need a naming system too. In the meantime, as new variants crop up, scientists are getting creative.
We Slack a lot and then we Zoom.
That's Von Cooper, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Pittsburgh. He was on the original conversation with Jeremy Camille in Louisiana about how to refer to these new variants. Emma Hodgraff, the scientist in Switzerland, had an idea.
It occurred to me that it might be fun to name these after birds in America.
I loved it. We're like, we're going to go with that. Thank you, Emma.
We have pelican, yellowhammer, robin one and robin two, quail and mockingbird.
Roadrunner and heron may be joining the flock soon.
We're using nature to describe nature.
Von Cooper doesn't see this as a permanent solution at all. And how many birds are too many birds? He and others hope a standard system is reached soon to avoid defaulting to geography and causing long-term damage and harm. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
And next Tuesday, Alana will be hosting a live discussion about these new variants. She'll be joined by epidemiologist William Hanage. It's part of a series with our partners at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Check out our website for more details. That's theworld.org. You can ask William Hanage your own question. Email us at myworld@theworld.org. President Biden wants to reopen America's doors to refugees after the previous administration prided itself on slowing refugee resettlement. Biden signed an executive order to this effect early this month, and in it, he ordered government agencies to produce a report on options for resettling people displaced by climate change. As global temperatures rise, the impacts of climate displacement are getting worse. What the Biden administration could do is the topic of today's Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports.
On the day he signed his executive order, President Biden made it very clear. His administration sees addressing climate change as at the center of U.S. foreign policy.
America must lead in the face of this existential threat. And just as with the pandemic, it requires global cooperation.
The international community has been working on the issue of climate migration for years, but those displaced by drought, flooding, hurricanes, or other climate impacts do not qualify as refugees or for any special international protections. Maria Franco de Vonel, a researcher at the University of Exeter, says that's partly because there's no legally binding definition of a climate migrant.
It's very difficult to disentangle what is the effect of environmental change on migration.
If a family's crops fail because there's not enough rain, do they leave their land as climate migrants or economic ones?
Is it just the climate change that actually triggered this move, or is it also social aspects and the economic aspects of it?
It's also hard for scientists to pinpoint exactly how much climate change fuels a particular weather event or disaster.
The idea of defining a climate migrant into a category has been pretty much abandoned.
François Germain is an environmental migration expert at the University of Liège in Belgium.
Because first, it's complicated, and because it was considered as a political no-go.
A political no-go because of the rise of nationalism and anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe and the United States.
The way that has been taken so far has been a kind of more pragmatic way. That is, let's not try and think of a status in international law, but let's try and think of some programs and some projects that could make a difference on the ground.
Germain points to a few examples. A free movement protocol being implemented in the Horn of Africa. And the African Union has something called the Kampala Convention. It requires signatories to protect people internally displaced by climate change.
So that's not to say that the idea of granting asylum or granting a status will never materialize. But clearly, we, the international community, didn't wait for this to implement projects on the ground.
Advocates say something like that could work in the U.S. A start could be an expansion of the Temporary Protected Status Program. That's a designation that applies to immigrants from countries facing threats like armed conflict or environmental disasters. Kaylee Ober works on climate displacement at Refugees International.
Temporary protected status has been spoken of by different advocates in this space for many years, kind of held up as an example of a humanitarian visa that explicitly has environmental disaster within its definition. It does have a lot of challenges or gaps.
One is that, by definition, it's temporary. Marduel Hernandez received temporary protected status in 1999 after Hurricane Mitch left 1.5 million people in his native Honduras homeless. That included members of Hernandez's extended family.
Some of them lost their homes, their farms, their crops. Basically, they were gone.
Hernandez has been in the U.S. for decades, but the threat of deportation never really goes away. Temporary protected status comes up for renewal every 6 to 18 months.
It is a nightmare every 18 months because we don't know if it's going to be renewed, it's going to be canceled. And that right there is a nightmare.
Hernandez is part of an advocacy group pushing for permanent status for TPS holders like himself. Haley Ober from Refugees International says that option could help make the program part of a comprehensive U.S. policy on climate-induced migration. So would expanding the use of TPS beyond one-time disasters, like hurricanes and earthquakes.
Something more slow burn like drought, desertification, leading to food insecurity, that's not really taken into account. And that's a shame because that's really what most people who are on the edge are facing. Refugees International would absolutely advocate for slower onset impacts to be a part of any sort of TPS designation in the future.
More sweeping change would require new legislation. A 2019 bill would have admitted 50,000 people displaced by climate change each year into the U.S., but that legislation didn't get far, and a group of House Republicans has already written a letter to the Biden administration signaling their opposition to expanding protections for climate migrants. But Biden's executive order on refugees and climate migration may already be having an impact because it sends a message to the international community, says environmental migration expert Francois Germain.
At the moment, these are signals that show the willingness of the U.S. to re-engage in a debate which they had deserted 4 years ago.
How exactly the U.S. will engage will become clearer this summer. That's when the report on climate migration Biden called for in his executive order will come due. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Three LGBTQ activists in Poland were in court this week. They faced charges of offending religious beliefs for hanging up posters of the Virgin Mary with a rainbow halo. Activists say the case is just the latest attack on the LGBTQ community in Poland, where state-sanctioned homophobia is common practice. The World's Bianca Hillier has the details.
Back in April of 2019, Polish activists Elżbieta, Anya, and Joanna hung up these posters in front of a Catholic church in Płock. Inside this particular church was an Easter art installation that listed a bunch of sins: greed, hate, envy, and...
Among those sins, there were gender and LGBT. These were also supposed to be sins.
Karolina Gierdal is a lawyer for a Polish organization called Campaign Against Homophobia. She says the activists were trying to spread a message of acceptance.
To actually use a symbol of love, of maternal love, to put a rainbow halo in there, to say that everybody is loved.
It didn't go over well. According to Amnesty International, police were called and they raided Elżbieta's house. They took her laptop, phone, and memory cards. After a year-long investigation, Elżbieta, Anya, and Joanna, whose last names haven't been released for security reasons, were all charged under a specific part of Poland's criminal code. Article 196. Basically, this article makes it illegal to offend religious feelings by publicly insulting an object of religious worship or a place designated for public religious ceremonies. Activists argue this infringes on the right to freedom of expression.
Freedom of expression in terms of what you say, but also in terms of artistic expression, is being curtailed in Poland under this Article 196.
Belinda Deer is an advocacy officer at ILGA Europe, an organization supporting the activists.
The law needs to be very clearly defined so that the offender can adapt their freedom of expression to be in line with the law. And Article 196 is vaguely worded, and it leaves space for arbitrary interpretation.
That, she says, is what's happening with Elżbieta, Anya, and Joanna's case. Belinda added that Article 196 also breaks international human rights laws that Poland is supposed to abide by. A lot of people are on the activist side. LGBTQ advocates have gathered outside the courthouse for each of the hearings. Online, supporters use the hashtag RainbowsDoNotOffend, and nearly 150,000 have signed onto a campaign asking prosecutors to drop the charges against the women. I asked Belinda if she has hope that they will.
No. It's a short answer is no. Unfortunately, we don't have much hope. The government does not have any interest in protecting women's rights or LGBTI rights in any way.
Elżbieta, Anya, and Joanna face up to 2 years in prison. Lawyer Karolina Gierdal doesn't think they'll get the full sentence, but says the verdict will be a political decision aimed at a chilling effect.
Telling everyone that even a rainbow flag, a very peaceful symbol that is optimistic and says a lot about human equality and about love and respect for each other, is something that we can prosecute you for.
Scare tactics like this, she added, won't work on these activists.
Because Elżbieta, Anya, and Joanna are really courageous, and they are not going to stop being activists and being active in the field of human rights.
Still, Karolina worries that a harsh verdict on this case will deter the masses from putting on a rainbow sticker or flying a flag from their balcony. But outside the final hearing this week, rainbow flags flew without hesitation. Advocates showed their support with music and rainbow streamers, despite freezing temperatures and active snowfall. The judge didn't give a verdict. It'll be announced on March 2nd. But the signs outside the courthouse sent a clear message to the activists. They read, "You will never walk alone." For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Yesterday, humankind witnessed an amazing accomplishment in space exploration. NASA landed a rover on Mars, the Perseverance. Its job? To search for ancient signs of life on the red planet. One of the people who made this possible is Diana Trujillo. She's an aerospace engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab who worked on the rover's robotic arm. And she also led the first ever Spanish language NASA transmission of a planetary landing yesterday.
¡Hemos llegado! Perseverance llegó. Hemos llegado. Confirmado.
Confirmed. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the signs of past life.
Diana, I have to know, what did that moment feel like for you to see the rover successfully touch down?
I could not believe that we had just done what we had. In fact, the images are the ones that actually helped me sink in the ginormous step that we just took. And I'm still looking at them like I can't believe that we did that.
So the name of the rover is Perseverance. And not to be too corny, but it could be an apt title for your story as well. Tell us a little bit about your journey and how you came to be an engineer at NASA.
I came from Colombia with $300 in my pocket. I didn't know any English. I didn't know what I was going to do next. But I knew I was not going to, I was not going to come back to my country until I had done whatever I had to do here and become somebody that I was proud of. Yeah, I got here, I started to work immediately. I had 4 jobs and I was going through school learning English. And then eventually I found out about space science and took my route through aerospace engineering and made it to NASA. And this is my second Mars mission.
Now, yesterday you led the first Spanish language NASA transmission of a planetary landing. Are you hoping that seeing that might open the door to science and tech for other young Spanish speaking women?
My whole driver for all of this was and is to continue to take science to everybody in their own languages. It feels like a division, right? When you do a ginormous historic step, but we only do it in one language, especially in the middle of a pandemic where everybody's at their homes and feeling down about the whole situation and how we treat each other as humans. To be very specific, I was looking for three outcomes. The first outcome was for, you know, las abuelas, the grandmas, to turn around and say, mijita, you can do it. She's doing it. You can do it. For the parents to say, keep going, because if she can, you can. And then for the younger generation to have that moment of inspiration to decide, I want that job.
Diana Trujillo is an aerospace engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory who worked on the Perseverance Mars rover. It's a great story, Diana. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And we'll sign off from Planet Earth this Friday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you on Monday.